Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jerry LaFemina. Jerry LaFemina is the author of six collections of poetry, including Vanishing Horizon, Anhinga Press, 2011, Graffiti Heart, winner of the Anthony Picone Prize in Poetry, The Window Facing Winter, and The Parakeets of Brooklyn, winner of the Bordighera Prize, two collections of prose poems, and Wishlist, a collection of short stories. A former punk musician and a former member of the Associated Writing Program's Board of Directors, he directs the Frostburg Center for Creative Writing at Frostburg State University, where he also teaches. He divides his time between Maryland and New York. Hi, Jerry. How are you?
I'm great, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you. You have a great new book, and you've been on before, but we have to have you back because you keep writing books.
Well, nothing can stop me, fortunately, or unfortunately, maybe.
No, fortunately. So you're going to start with some poems from Vanishing Horizon.
Yeah, this is after reading Rex Roth, I Step Outside. Low moon tonight, nearly full. See how it illuminates the alien bodies of mushrooms colonizing the weedy lawn. They're a surprise after 6 weeks of near drought, delivered no doubt by the drizzle that followed. Their fibrous necks lifting up their heads so they seem to look in wonder. There was that time I went morel hunting with a woman I thought I loved. We carried two plastic grocery bags and a blanket and lunch. We spent our morning searching around the bases of birch and pine and by the area also where fire had created a richness of soil. I had thought maybe we'd find some mushrooms, eat lunch, and then make love on that blanket, the smell of moist nature, of decay and growth surrounding us, and thus that ground would be consecrated. But we were confounded to find at first the bones of what we believed to be a large animal, some ribs and vertebrae, and, excited by this discovery, we dug around till we found the long femur of what was most likely a young child, a handful of metatarsals. How she drew in her breath, a slight, high-pitched whistle. The flesh, of course, was gone. Who knows how long the body had rotted in the rotten earth? The police arrived inevitably. Inevitably, we had to retrace our steps back to that place, a mile from a state highway, where she had laid the blanket above the remains and held it firm with rocks, as if such a gesture might make a difference. All that first night, she wept and shivered, and there was no comforting her. For who could sleep with milky light filling our bare windows in that way? And this is a kind of holiness. Then a shoplifter ran across the street, followed by a cashier. Then a choir of brakes emphasized by the percussion of a body contacting a car fender. Then sobbing, and eventually sirens. We were there, a crowd of us, and among us may have been the thief who had slipped back to see what had happened, some bauble, how little was it worth, in his pocket that he fingered. Then police officers dispersed the crowd, ensuring us there was nothing to see, which wasn't exactly true. Years passed. Rain washed whatever blood had been spilled down the gutters, water cascading toward the sewer grates. I was lonely then. I kept my head downcast no matter what the weather, and whatever I witnessed, I never snitched. This, I believed, a kind of holiness. Though that night, after I undressed for bed, I prayed for the woman and the driver and the thief who worked in the noble tradition of those who hung beside Jesus, prayed on my knees the way the nuns had taught, prayed for myself too, and for the last time. For the last time, that is, till tonight. When I thought of you and thought of my loneliness, then heard sirens cresting Little Savage Mountain, and knew I had this one opportunity to make something, even if I won't say what, make something right again. And this last poem is a short poem named after tropical fruit, and there are several of these in the book. This is papaya. Perhaps the heart is more like a papaya. It takes a large knife to split it, and we could eat its pink meat, but only after we've scooped its black seeds, mucusy like spawn, which we leave on a small plate. Later, the hard green husk remains, left leathery as a sadness, as the memory of a sadness.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jerry LaFemina. He's reading from his new book, Vanishing Horizon. It's published by Anhinga Press. Jerry, I wanted to ask you about the idea of We Were There. That's from one of the poems you just read, We Were There. And we were talking right before the show about someone who was at a reading of yours talking to you about one of your poems, and they were angry with you because you said, oh, none of that really happened. Can you talk about not that exact thing, that exact circumstance, but that idea?
Well, I think it's important to realize that we're witnesses to the world, and that not just what we see, not just what we experience, but what makes the human species so amazing is that we can imagine and empathize with other people's experience. I mean, that's emotional intelligence. And so I never found a dead body, but I know those things happen, and I can imagine what it would be like if I did. And so I took an experience that I almost did, which was go morel mushroom hunting with a woman I thought I loved, and then imagined, well, what would happen if? What if? I mean, my life stories bore me. I've lived them. I've told them. There's no poetry in that for me. Charles Simic says, I can imagine 1,000 lives in which I'd be perfectly happy or perfectly miserable. And I think my job as a poet is to witness those lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, how can you tell if you're imagining the lives of others or projecting your own self onto their lives?
Well, I'm imagining a different life for me. I like to say that the speaker in these poems is everything I'm glad I'm not and everything I hope I am simultaneously. Galway Kinnell says every poem starts with a spark of autobiography, but if it's truly a poem, it has to transcend that autobiography. And so I would imagine having experienced death in strange ways. I once had a body of a suicide jumper land about 8 feet in front of me. I'd been cutting class. I've written about that. But I think we respond to death, to sudden, surprising, shocking death, similarly as a species. And I think that we are a species of great empathy. And ultimately, I'm trying to create a sense of empathy, both for this imagined character, but if I can find some empathy for the speaker in these poems and for the other people in the poems, then I think the reader can too. I mean, that whole idea of the piece of art as the experience, that's not something that just the experience of me making the art, but of somebody reading the poem and engaging it. One of the rules I have is that the characters in a poem always have to feel like real people. I have to treat them like they're real and not just a source, not just a tool in the poem.
Mm-hmm. So the person who was angry at you for not having told a so-called true story, why were they so angry?
Because they believed what I said was factual, mm-hmm. which means that the poem was successful.
Mm-hmm. Did they leave feeling happy?
I don't want to ever be responsible for anybody's happiness but my own, Jan. Thank you.
I wasn't saying you're responsible. I just wondered if...
I think they left thinking about poetry differently. Okay. I mean, I think a lot of people come from that, oh, poetry is confessional, and everything that the writer says is what happened.
I know.
And we live in the shadow of that.
Right, especially women.
My last name means the woman, so I...
Yes, and yet, you're not one. Okay. Okay, so you're going to read some more poems from Vanishing Horizon.
This is January 1st, 2008. First squirrel of the year walks westward on its wire, while the trees shudder then steady. In the middle of my sleep, sirens woke me and then were gone. Now morning unpacks its suitcase of sunlight, and the brilliant blue of promise mixes with regret. This is how the wind moves us all and pushes the moral of our story further into obscurity. Having gotten its invitation, a storm front will visit later, heading east as if to meet the day. This is the silence that follows. It's early summer in Grayling, and death has no business here, despite my neighbor celebrating his 93rd June. Black flies convene above the ruffled surface of the Ausable, while adolescents dream of canoeing toward Wakely Bridge with dates or their fathers. On street corners, the stands are up, some selling cherry bombs and rockets, some selling old Mission cherries. I knew a young woman, yes, years ago, who could twist cherry stems into knots with her tongue, and what young man wouldn't love that? All I could do was spit the pits of those tart fruits and never far enough to win a ribbon at Cherry Fest. All I could do was tell her I love you, but there was no ribbon for that either. Still, I'll stop my car along the shoulder of West 72, buy a pound of cherries, and admire their Merlot bodies, their skin taut and rounded. I could be in love all over again with the scent of fresh cherries. When it ended, there was nothing our tongues could do, no words we might tie together to make anything all right. Her name translates into I love or I like. I lived 3 blocks from Mercy Hospital then, though there was no mercy to be had that long August in the empty cardboard of our house. I sat and listened to ambulances rushing in. The sirens howled like a lonely man or like a lonely woman. It's early summer in Grayling, and I have $3 worth of cherries, and I never did learn how she did that trick with her tongue and the stem, though I used to finger those knots like a Persian reading a rug. Translation's such a subjective art. I'd say her name twice in a row. I like, I like. And now I've stopped saying it at all and stopped even thinking of her. Tonight, I'll eat Michigan cherries from brown paper and from my porch watch an ambulance hurry with its charges. Behind it, a car full of prayers. In the silence that follows, I might hear the river only a block away, a quick splashing of something crossing over to the near shore. I'm going to change the mood up a little bit. This is Go Hawaiian. In 8th grade, Jill Frangos and I sang the Hawaiian Punch theme song like Donnie and Marie. Not like them, we kissed in the coat closet or behind the church where we confessed our sins and tried to make each other giggle before Eucharist. In 8th grade, we made promises to each other we didn't know we couldn't keep. In 8th grade, Jill Frango shot 24 foul shots in a row while I hit 2, my 3rd missing hoop and backboard completely. She didn't care, her voice like candy thrown at a parade. In 8th grade, I knew nothing and still scored perfectly on algebra exams, history exams, spelling exams, and so earned a spot in the back corner right beside Jill Frango's. There, we sang and made fun and invited each other over for Friday night fish dinners with spaghetti. Her mother once chaperoned us at the roller rink. We skated the oval countless times, our fingers interlocked counterclockwise with the other skaters, as if we were all trying to keep it 8th grade forever. Already, my voice faltered when we sang Hawaiian Punch. Already, my facial hair darkened. When Jill Frangos fell that day, she pulled me down beside her for a minute as long as 8th grade, while our laughter diffused in the scattered dimes of a disco ball's light, and neither of us wanted to get back up.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jerry LaFemina. He's reading from his new book, Vanishing Horizon.
You know, Jan, I want to just say something real quick about what we were talking about witness and fact and not fact and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of that poem that I just read with Jill Frangos is made up, but Jill Frangos is a real person from grammar school. I read from this book in Staten Island where I went to grammar school, and a group of people from that school showed up at the reading, including Jill Frangos, whom I did not recognize, and who came up to me afterward and said, "You owe me a fish dinner."
There's always repercussions, you know.
I very quickly started editing names.
Yeah, I usually change last names or don't use last names, but interesting. Well, before that Go Hawaiian poem, I was going to ask you about, you know, all the death and sorrow in your poems, which there is a lot. There is a lot. There's ambulances, people dying. I mean, which is part of life, but...
They're often rubbed up right against the love poems.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is an interesting book. It took me a long time to figure out what the arc of this book was. And it starts with a poem called Returning Home in the MG, and it ends with this phenomenology, The Vanishing Horizon. It starts with a return home, and it ends with a leaving. And what I realized I did, not knowing at first when I started this, was I'd written the sort of anti-hero story. The hero story starts with a leaving and then the return home with treasure. And really, I'd written a book about the dissolution and desolation of my marriage. And the poems were all over the place. I mean, literally, geographically, they're in the Caribbean, they're in California, they're in New York, they're in Michigan, they're in Maryland and the mountains of this area in West Virginia, they're in Florida. And what I realized I'd been doing was sort of writing about, you know, it's that whole great mystery, wherever you go, there you are. And that, you know, there's what does it mean to be home? What does it mean to be on the road? There's a real sense of the death of something going on throughout this book. Okay. And it took me a long time to figure out what it was. But it's also why those poems are often also simultaneously love poems or about lost love in some way.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot more sense now that you're saying that. For our listeners out there who are not writers, who might think, you know, that's strange to not have no idea what you're writing about until later. Can you talk about that process? Because how could you not know? I mean, I'm familiar with it, but how could you not know what you're writing about?
I think our obsessions are our obsessions. And I think the worst poems come when you say, I'm going to force my obsession, or I think I know what this poem, I'm going to make this poem about X or Y or Z, because what's going on in the back of our minds is often not what's going on in the front of our minds. And even our non-writer, non-artistic listeners know that. They're having a conversation with somebody and suddenly they go, oh my God, that reminds me of something I have to do, or that reminds me of this other thing. Usually what happens for me is I start a poem with an image, something catches my eye, and then the writing of the poem helps me explore why it caught my eye or why it caught my attention. Because it's you know, whatever it is catching on something inside of me.
Right.
And let's face it, we have 20 different obsessions a minute. You know, I mean, it's not like we have one or two.
I only have two. Maybe you have 20, Jerry.
I juggle. What can I say? I juggle my obsessions. But you start going, gee, all these poems seem to have a connection. There's a lot of meditation in them. There's some death. There's a lot of love.
And there's Hawaiian punch.
There's a lot of tropical fruit. There's a lot of tropical fruit in these poems.
Can you read the MG poem?
Sure.
Okay.
Returning home in the MG just before dawn. The last rags of cloud have dispersed, displaying the harvest moon's mandala burnished, but seeming as far away as a saxophone a friend retired 4 years ago, the one she sometimes pulls from the closet, not to play, but rather to hear the reedy echo of song lodged in its long esophagus. Imagine that song is a hymn. Imagine it is sung by a famished cat on the front porch. Imagine it sung by vibrations of the last struck chord on the stand-up piano shoved in grandmother's living room corner. Sung by the engine at 4,000 RPM. Sung by the grackle right before dawn. How soon I return to the rind of this world, the misgivings of sparrows and neighbor kids who wake with my arrival, the lawn laminated with dew, my house barren, shut down like a stage but for the porch light, which brightens a spider's safety net stretched tightly between two skeletal limbs of birch.
Yeah, nice poem.
Thank you. It's an ambient poem, and it's there to sort of set the mood for the whole book, which is the idea of a safety net in a spider's web. You know, it's a spider's web is not safe for most of the things that land there, as it turns out.
And it's set off from all the other poems as the initial poem.
And I've had an MG for years, and I did a reading from this book in a tattoo parlor last year, and they tattooed the MG logo on me. I'm very happy with as payment.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I didn't know that. Okay. if we were on television, we could show that. But okay. Can you read some more poems, please?
Sure. This is another tropical fruit poem. This is mango. Delicious slivers of mango, cut like long tongues, so it's as if we eat our passion, this longing, sticky like the afterglow of sex, our skin the reddish model of mango skin. So often I've eaten these alone, bought at some Upper West Side bodega and sliced open with a pocket knife. I'd sit in Riverside Park, sunset orange in the Hudson below, sunset orange with a knife blade in it, bleeding orange in my hands. And this is Perfidia, which is a song by The Ventures. Sunday begins with The Ventures, with that trebly lead guitar tremolo just right. Their sound a perfect trinity of blues, rock and roll, and Hawaiian. That's how surf was born, the songs like waves. The neighborhood church, like a fire siren, calls the faithful to 10 o'clock services, an excited flurry of bells. On the first spring morning in this latest year of our Lord, in another $1 million weekend I can't afford, I'll excuse myself again from Mass and from the prayers I've never forgotten and from the hymns I sang through childhood. Let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. Yeah, sure, the guitar's counter. Noki Edwards playing lead again, all vibrato and reverb, that familiar lick, walk, don't run.
I think you're a little pitchy on that, Jerry. I'm just going to say. Okay. Before you move on, I wanted to ask you one thing about narrative before we finish up. I feel like you're very loyal to narrative, I mean, in your work. I always feel a fully told story, even though there's plenty of details not there, but just that sense of story is so strong in your work.
You know, I think that for experience to have import, then you need context. And what narrative does, even in the short poems, narrative implies some sort of context. And I try to not tell a story, but to infer or to imply a story as much as possible so that you go, oh, I get why this was relevant. I feel that.
I mean, plenty of more languagey poets would disagree with that. But.
Yeah, they would.
Okay, then.
Well, I mean, but their whole mission is to sort of say even language doesn't matter, that those things that we share don't matter. I mean, their mission is not one I agree with. It's kind of like asking me about Republican politics. I just don't get it. So therefore I can't respond to it beyond a certain point.
Okay. Can you read some more?
Yeah, this is Alphabet City, which is an area in New York where Tompkins Square Park is, which was, you know, affectionately known as Needle Park for a while. And it's an abracadarian, so every line starts with the next letter of the alphabet. After the ambulances left, but before the sun finally rose above Avenue C, I walked toward Tompkins Square Park, where the heroin-dependent rockers slept, addled on benches, while ex-punks huddled in their leather jackets, for the morning was still damp. One of them called out, "Jerry? What was I to do when I saw her, recognized her hesitant, familiar eyes? How could I have imagined things would turn out this way when I'd call out her name, Joanna, those sleepless nights of high school, and kept a photo of her deep into college? Longing has such a sense of history. Morning was approaching in its colorful coat. Not once those months of kissing her had I wakened beside her, but, oh, I'd wanted to. She was thinner and glanced away when I nodded. Pigeons surrounded her bench but would take off quickly with the first sudden movement or when the next squad car revealed itself in flashers and sirens. So what did I do? What could I do? The $3 $5 bills folded in my pocket, what use were they to me? I gave them to her, she who'd once been beautiful. How victorious I'd felt that first time I kissed her. We didn't look at each other, nor did we look askance. I thought of the little xiphoid syringes she might load with that money. This was my sin. Two young black kids with dreadlocks walked by singing, "Zion, take me back to Zion," and I knew I'd never be saved. This is the sacrosanct. In Manhattan again, in the midst of midtown businessmen and women with briefcases and designer sunglasses, I stop at D'Agostino's, where I buy 2 apples, 2 blood oranges, and 2 apricots. I am not hungry. There's the R train downtown to Canal Street, Chinatown's sulfurous tip. I walk east and south in blocks to find this place I've been many times before. As always, I bow to the Buddha and to the old woman who sweeps the floor and to the monk's creased bald head. He is a walking wick, aglow in his silence. I place 2 apricots, 2 oranges, and 1 apple before that statue. There's enough fruit here already, grapefruits bigger than my fists, mangoes, bananas. And what of my other apple? I gave it to the ragman bound for Brooklyn. He eyed the fruit suspiciously, holding it up to the artificial light for 60 long seconds, till finally he bit into it with a spray of sweet juices that christened his chin, golden in that yellow glow. "Mmm, delicious," he said, "delicious like a chorus rocking southbound 70 feet beneath those streets."
The poetry of Jerry LaFemina, reading from his book, Vanishing Horizon. Thanks so much, Jerry. It was great.
Thank you, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.